3, 2, 1.
You ready?
You're listening to the Real Pineapple Podcast Network.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. This is The Real Pineapple. This is your humble host, Hunter, here. I hope you're all having a great day, weekend, whenever you listen to this. So, quick story time. I actually had my best of 2021 reviewed, recorded, back in January, and I've kind of just been waiting on when I was going to release it. And in recording a couple weeks ago, I accidentally recorded or saved over my best of 2021 list, so I went, oh crap, that sucks. So now this is actually me re-reviewing it, but I have a few different things I wanted to bring up about the films that I enjoyed, so it's kind of a blessing in disguise. 2021 was an incredible year for film. I am so incredibly grateful that to all of you who listened to reviews, who commented, who shared. I appreciate you all more than I will ever be able to put into words. I am grateful that for whatever reason there are those of you who keep listening to this podcast, keep having fun with it. Again, forever grateful to you for that. And as we're slowly, I mean, as we're still dealing with the pandemic, but at least we have a vaccine now, things seem less bleak in that sense. It really is a celebration, 2021 was, as far as film. I'm so incredibly happy I had film last year to distract me, to motivate me, to inspire me, to comfort me at points when I really needed it. So these are the films that I love the most. This is the best of 2021 from yours truly. So let me get into the rules in case you haven't listened to one of these lists before. So basically, I'm going to do my 10 through 6. Then my 5 through 2, then I'll go ahead, I'll recap the list in its entirety up from 10 to 2, and then I'll reveal my number 1 film. But before we get to that, there are a couple films I wanted to go ahead and give some credit to that are honorable mentions. So one of them is a Best Oscar winner for Best Documentary. I have not reviewed it yet for the channel. I probably will this summer just because, I mean, the word summer's in its title. It's A Summer of Soul, which was directed, of course, by Questlove. That won Best Documentary at the Academy Awards, and because of the amount of traction and the footprint that this film, that this documentary left, they're going ahead and bringing back the Summer of Soul concert next year, I believe, in 2023. So I'm so happy for Questlove. The Oscar was well deserved. You know, despite Will Smith's bullshit, no one can ever take away the fact that Questlove is now a fucking Oscar winner. And I'm so proud of that brother. He's one of my favorite musicians ever, and I'm just so happy that he got his moment to shine. So yeah, Summer Soul, it's on Disney Plus, it's on Hulu. If you have not seen it, make the time. It's well worth your attention, and it's an incredibly well done documentary. So Summer Soul, that's one. Another film that I just absolutely fucking adore was The Last Duel. Ridley Scott, yes. God, what's that movie? House of Gucci. House of Gucci is has some good stuff about it, but overall is just a mess. The Last Duel, I think, is just too uncomfortable for people, to be quite blunt. Ben Affleck, that's one of the best performances he's had in the last 5 years. I think Affleck was genuinely amazing in the film. The Last Duel is also, it's a hard watch. And I really do understand people just kind of going, fuck, I don't want to watch this. Because a lot of it is watching Jodie Comer, you know, at its core, watching her just going through having to go ahead and relive herself being sexually assaulted. It's fucking terrible. And I will say myself, as someone who, or a patriarchy, womp womp, watching her deal with the patriarchy and having these men, you know, call her a whore and go, you know, you can't get pregnant if you like it. And it's a hard fucking watch. And considering the Roe v. Wade shit that this country is going through right now, which, oh my God, I'll get that I'll get into that at a later date. This is a heartbreaking fucking watch. In a slower film year, this would easily be my top 10. Matt Damon is maybe the most unlikable he's been in a film role in this. He's a bastard in this movie. And yeah, Ben Affleck playing King Charles, like, he's a piece of shit too. But Affleck almost feels like he knows he's a piece of shit. He just loves to get drunk and fuck around and fuck women. Like, I mean, that sounds like a fun day. But Affleck, I think, kind of knows he's a piece of shit. Matt Damon, his character, he feels like he truly does believe that he is the hero. And it's fascinating to see the point of views of Matt Damon's character, Adam Driver's character, Affleck's character, Jodie Comer's character. Jodie Comer, goddamn, you want to talk about someone who is really elevating their stock. Just between The White Princess and Killing Eve alone, she would already be, you know, in that upper tier. But then you look at how she was in Free Guy, which she damn near steals the movie from Ryan Reynolds, and she is the best performance in this film. So while I understand it is on a comfortable watch and not something that, you know, you may want to watch, I would really encourage you, if you've not seen this, to go ahead and give it a chance. It's an incredibly well done film. It is well worth your time. So check this out. And then last film, I'll throw out two more. Don't Look Up, the latest Adam McKay film. It's cynical as hell, but unfortunately it's realistic as hell. This is the most I've liked Jennifer Lawrence in a while, honestly. I thought she absolutely killed it. Seeing Leonardo DiCaprio go ahead and freak out, that is always something that I am always down to see more of. He was great. Even my nemesis, Tyler Perry, is, I can't say good, he's okay. And Cate Blanchett, oh my god, you want to talk about someone who, whenever I see Cate Blanchett in something, it never feels like she's phoning it in, which is such a nice fucking concept. You know someone is actually going to step up and bring it. She's incredible in it. Ariana Grande gets a fun little bit that she gets to do as far as her character. Timothy Chalamet, I fucking loved him in this. He's not in the film a lot, but he was great. Melanie Linsky, who you of course know from 2.5 Men and Yellow Jackets, she's in here as playing Leo's partner. And she's great for the bits she gets. Really, from start to finish, it is a very well done film, and something that really leans into that whole satire bit that McKay has really started to find his niche in. And the way the film ends, I went, this is exactly what would happen. Oh yeah, Meryl Streep is kind of okay. I had a few issues with her. I didn't think the Streep was as evil as she kind of needed to be, given the circumstances, but that, I'll admit, is just kind of a personal preference. It's still an incredibly well-done movie and something you should check out. It's on Netflix. Give it a watch if you haven't watched it. And I will throw out one more. Spider-Man No Way Home. If you've listened to our review of it, if you haven't, you should. I love No Way Home. I think it's an incredibly well-done film, but the humor bits from Jamie Foxx for me were misses, but that's really my biggest complaint about the film, which, you know, if that's my biggest complaint, I think the film is doing pretty great. But yeah, it's an incredibly well done film. Willem Dafoe brings it in a way that I just went, oh my god. Like, Willem Dafoe phoned it in like a motherfucker in Aquaman, and he's still one of the best performances. He's fucking haunting in this movie, and I loved Dafoe in this. I think Holland gives his best performance as Peter Parker / Spider-Man in this film. Benedict Cumberbatch adds a level of gravity to the film, being portraying Stephen Strange once again in here. Yeah, and of course, you know, the surprises that happen near the end of the film are an absolute blast and just made me cry, made me cheer. Absolutely great movie. So that's another honorable mention. And I'm gonna be a total liar. I'm gonna throw out two more. I'll throw out one more. Shiva Baby. Shiva Baby is basically the most uncomfortable social gathering that you could possibly imagine. I'm gonna just leave it at that for those who haven't seen the movie, but it's on HBO Max, I believe, still. Make time to watch this. Even if you have to pay the $5 or what have you to go on VOD and watch it. If it's not on HBO Max still, it is well worth your time. Please, for the love of God, watch this movie. It is such a blast. And it's only like 85 minutes, so it's a quick watch too. Yeah, Shiva Baby rules. Everyone should see that. All right, moving on to the list proper. So, as I mentioned, I'm going to do my 10 through 6. Then my 5 through 2, I will do a recap. And then I'll get to my number one film. All right, so my number 10, I am going to be a total bastard. I'm going to cheat. But it's my list, so shut up. I have a tie for my number 10 because these are two films that I rewatched actually about within the last couple months, actually, and just went, God, I love both of these. I would feel terrible leaving one of these off my list. So I kept going back and forth and I couldn't find a way to knock one off. So they're both going to make the list. My number 10s in a tie. First film is going to be Pig. I thought Nicolas Cage delivered one of the best performances of his entire career. I think it is an extreme crock of shit that Nicolas Cage can't even get a nomination and Will Smith won for that King Richard bullshit. Not even including the slap. If you've listened to our King Richard review, which is on the channel, it's a fucking terrible movie. It's The Blind Side, but most of the cast is black. I fucking hate King Richard. I think Pig is a mesmerizing, beautifully quiet film that we really don't see Nicolas Cage do too often anymore. But he gives this incredibly bleak, dark, yet hopeful performance considering how Pig ends up. I think it's an incredible start to finish. Pacing never felt too long, always was engaged. The score is one of my favorite scores in a film in 2021. And yeah, it got fucking ignored by the Academy, which angers me beyond belief. Pig is on Hulu. You can watch it on Hulu. Please watch this fucking movie. If you've not watched Pig, do yourself a favor, take this movie, I think it's about 100 minutes, but take the time, watch it. It is well worth your time, and I truly believe you'll enjoy it. And then the other film I have to throw out is Ghostbusters Afterlife. I went into this movie excited, admittedly, but concerned, because when we think back to the 2016 Ghostbusters, we did review that. I didn't hate it, but it is just such a underwhelming, massive disappointment, considering the talent involved. Jason Reitman, yell nepotism all you want, but considering who his dad was, if there was someone who was going to continue on the Ghostbusters franchise, I'm happy it is Jason Reitman. He stepped up and delivered a film for me that is way closer for me in quality to the original Ghostbusters than it has any fucking right to be. McKenna Grace is just fucking special playing Phoebe. She is the anchor of the film. She carries this film. She has a confidence about her that really makes you want to cheer for her. Finn Wolfhard, their sibling dynamic really worked for me. It comes across as exactly as brother sisterly as it needs to, as far as the squabbling and the arguing. But when it comes down for shit to get real and for them to truly, work together, it never feels forced. It feels really organic. I don't have the actor's name here, but the young kid who played Podcast, as much as that would normally annoy me, he even finds a way to get past that dumb name. But given what he does, it actually makes sense. I enjoyed this film so much. The amount of heart that this film has, and it feels like its own thing, but definitely while celebrating the canon that it's based on, it sets up for a hell of a potential for a sequel, which was confirmed, thank God. And and Paul Rudd. Oh my God, Paul Rudd. He's kind of great in this. The visual effects are awesome. The scares, when they do come, are actually quite horrifying. There's a great chase sequence involving the Ecto-1, which is something I just went, oh my God, I just love this. And the last, I'll say 20-ish minutes, are some of my favorite in the film all last year. So yeah, Pig and Ghostbusters Afterlife, those are tied for my number 10. All right, Moving on to my number 9. This is a film that I had to watch. I had to watch in pieces. I actually watched this twice. But having cats makes it harder for me to sit down and watch a film this long. Yuzuki Hamaguchi is what I'm going to roll with. Directed Drive My Car. And that is my number 9 film. The acting in this movie, across the board, it's heartbreaking. It's haunting. It's therapeutic. It really is about how we go ahead and, you know, how we don't communicate with people, how we don't want to move on, and how we don't want to confront the truth. I think it's Yuzuki. Yuzuki, our main character, he discovers something about his partner, and we go on this journey with him, really to find himself. And he is tortured in the way that an artist would be. As he's tortured in the way artists are. Pardon me. The dynamic between him and his partner is really fascinating, and what he finds out about them. What he finds out about himself because of his partner. The woman who ends up becoming his cab driver, Mizaki, that actress is incredible. And the chemistry between the two of them, that alone carries the film. And that's before we even get to the guy who plays Koji, who he has his own reasoning, his own motivations. And the scene, and you'll know it when you see it, there's a scene of Yuzuki and Koji sitting in a car, and they're just talking to each other, and the camera is just bouncing back and forth between them as they're just talking to each other, as the skyline is in the background. And the way this film is shot, it really feels like a documentary more than a film. But that scene in particular is one of my favorite scenes all year, just because of how it's shot and how you really feel like you're a fly on the wall witnessing that conversation. And that's before you get into the incredible score, the ending, which I just, my jaw's on the ground in the best way. This is a definition, last thing I'll say, of a movie teaching you and really rewarding you for the experience. Because the first hour, you're going to kind of just be like, wait, what's happening? The second hour, it does give you more context. But then the third hour really is a reward for sticking with the first two. And I'm not even saying like the movie's boring or anything like that, but some people just might feel overwhelmed because of the runtime and because the film does ask you to pay attention. And this movie, though, oh my God, the reward for paying attention, sticking with it, and being truly engaged. Even if you have to break this up into parts, I would recommend doing so. Don't let the runtime deter you from not watching this at all. You can break this into hour-long chunks and you will be good. But an absolutely amazing film, something that I honestly will probably revisit again before the end of the year, but something that I just absolutely adored. And I'm so happy that it got so many Oscar nominations, so that hopefully more people have watched it by now. So that is my number 9. Moving on to number 8. This gentleman is one of my favorite directors. This director is just one of the best that we have in the game right now. He only pretty much produces classics. That's all he does. My number 8 favorite film of 2021 is Last Night in Soho. Edgar Wright. This may not be his best film. Let me backtrack. This may not be his most enjoyable film, but it, you could argue it's his best directed film. Anya Taylor-Joy is fucking haunting. Her rendition of Downtown. I just love Anya Taylor-Joy so much. And Thomasin McKenzie, who you recognize from a couple things. Most notably, what was that Netflix movie? The King, I want to say. She's an incredible freaking actress. And at the end of the day, this is one of those films that it feels like it's a great Twilight Zone episode of a movie, because when you're kind of sitting there, you're like, what the fuck is happening? Like, what is the point of all this? Jojo Rabbit. That's what I was thinking of. God, should have known that. As you're watching the film, you are just sitting there kind of going, what the fuck is happening? And I love that about the movie, because all the little breadcrumbs it drops, all the little clues it gives you to lead up to what the film is about and what's happening. It's such a, oh shit, sort of moment. And sort of realization. I want to say it's about 40 minutes in, and I went, wait a minute. I think it's about. And so when it's revealed, I went, yep, fucking love this. And one of the most tense last 25 minutes, I'd say, I experienced in a film all last year. The cinematography is amazing. The score is captivating and just adds to the atmosphere. The Wright is using every camera trick and every trick that he's developed throughout his incredible filmmaking career. He's on full display from a directing perspective here. And also Matt Smith's Jack, where you find out what his relevance is. All the pieces for this movie just work so incredibly well. And fucking Terrence Stamp showing up in this shit and delivering a great performance. It's movie fucking rules. It's such an incredible thriller. Some great jump scares. Yeah, absolutely love this movie. Everyone needs to see it. Last Night in Soho, that is my number 8. Moving on to my number 7 favorite film. This is a director and actor that I'm just such a huge fan of. He did miss recently for me because he was in Tenet. And Tenet, as we all know, is fucking terrible. But when he's directing and when you feel the sense of this feels like such an authentic experience coming from this director in a way that I think is really important for him to get back to basics in this form. My number 7 favorite film was Belfast. I thought Kenneth Branagh kind of sat down at his computer or wherever he writes that and went, I want to go and do something for me. And this movie screams Kenneth Branagh, not just from that, from the action, and not the action, but from the from the way the film's directed. The fact that it's in black and white, I thought was such a wonderfully old cinema choice. And considering that the film is, you know, drawing heavily from Branagh's own experiences, and the fact that it's about Buddy, who's played by Jude Hill, you know, Branagh basically as a kid, it's so cool to see Branagh kind of let us into his world as a film director, and also kind of go and turn the lens inward and kind of talk about himself and talk about the circumstances when he was a kid. It's incredibly captivating watch. It's something that I found myself throughout the 97 minutes just on the edge of my seat for, because I was so impressed and so happy with just everyone who's in the film. It really pisses me off more that you get someone like Jamie Dornan, who Barb, and I cannot think of the name of that freaking movie, the Vista Del Mar movie. Between that and this, Dornan's a hell of a talent. I know, you know, Christian Grey bullshit aside, you get to see him sing in this, you get to see him be loving and not abusive in this, and the way that Dornan in particular works off of all the other actors and actresses in this, he has a screen presence that I went, this feels classic Hollywood, which is lends even more credibility to the setting that this film takes place in. I love this movie, and just from a director's standpoint and the cinematography, it alone is something you should see. But the amount of emotion that they're able to pull out of this film, not just because of circumstances, the war setting that we're in, but in the way that Buddy really does use film as an escape from the terrible circumstances that he's around. That's what I was doing during COVID, or during lockdown, what was really immersing myself in film and things that I love to try and just get through the next day. And I loved watching Buddy's journey. It's something that I haven't reviewed yet, and I really am gonna have to sit down and rewatch Belfast and crank out a review for it, because it really is something that I admire. I'm sad it didn't get more love. I think a lot of people might have missed this, but you shouldn't. It's well worth the, I don't think it's streaming anywhere yet. Pay the $5-6 whatever you need to pay to rent it. It is well worth your time, and it's something that I found myself crying at, cheering at, and when, you know, the house lights came on in my theater, it's something that I went, you know what, I would go back and see this again. Absolutely loved it. Belfast is my number 7. Moving on to number 6. This is a movie that I know a lot of people definitely missed, and it's a movie that you need to fucking watch. It has an incredible cast in it too, and I'll go through that here in a second. But It's directed and written by Edson Oda, who I believe this is his first, this is only like his second film ever. But the film itself in question is 9 Days. It stars Winston Duke, Zazie Beetz, Benedict Wong, Tony Hale, and Bill Skarsgård. And without getting too much into the plot of this, think about, it's very similar to something like What Dreams May Come is the best comparison I can make. If you weren't convinced for whatever reason that Winston Duke is one of the best actors we have, if you aren't convinced that Zazie Beetz is fucking special, this movie will do it, because those two really are the lifeblood of the film. The movie asks the big questions about, you know, what are we doing here? What happens when we die? What's the purpose of fucking life? It's one of the best scores I've heard in a film all year. It's a score I was actually listening to last week as I was doing some writing. I think the score is just excellent, but the way that this film truly does feel personal to Edson Oda, the fact he wrote and directed it, it really feels like, you know what it reminds me of? It also reminds me of that film that Clint Eastwood did, Hereafter. It reminds me a lot of that. This movie in particular really just questions humanity in a way that I went, this is fascinating to watch. And the thing is, I don't think the movie, it definitely lands on a place that I went, yep, I love where you landed here. But it's also not trying to answer all the questions. It really presents everything in a way that warrants discussion, that if you watch this with a group of friends, will definitely warrant discussion. It's something that stuck with me. The review is on the channel already. But if you have not seen this movie, it's not streaming anywhere. You will have to pay to rent it. But please pay to rent it. It's a movie that a lot of people miss. But I'm telling y'all, if you don't be one of those people looking at your cell phone while you're watching this, take the time, actually make time for this movie. Let the movie, you know, really just kind of wash over you. And the movie rewards you so much for giving it your undivided attention. Please watch this movie. It fucking rules. 9 Days. Number 6 film. So, let me count them back real quick. So, my 10 through 6, tied at number 10 is Pig and Ghostbusters Afterlife. Number 9 is Drive My Car. Number 8 is Last Night in Soho. Number 7 is Belfast. Number 6 is 9 Days. All right, moving on. So, this movie was actually what I thought was gonna be my favorite film of the year until I saw some other stuff. I went, oh, I have to knock this down the list a little bit. But son of a bitch, it's got some of my favorite acting performances in all of 2021. It has maybe the best cinematography in all of 2021. And Jane Campion, goddamn, what an incredible directing job. And she helped, and she wrote the script too, based on the novel by Thomas Savage. My number 5, it's Power of the Dog, starring Benedict, I'm a fucking asshole in this movie, Cumberbatch, because that is probably one of the things I love the most about this movie, is that Benedict Cumberbatch is almost playing Sherlock in the sense that he's just an asshole. But the thing is, unlike Sherlock Holmes, where he channels his, you know, being a dick and solving crimes, this guy is just out to torture Kirsten Dunst's Rose in a way that is so fucking stalkerish and cruel and straight up vile. And the way that he treats her son Peter, played by Cody Smith McPhee, goddamn, Cumberbatch is despicable in this. And it's really nice to see Cumberbatch get into, almost getting back to his theater roots as far as just being just a vile character, because, you know, we've seen him as Doctor Strange and you know, for a good amount of time here, I think so many people are just like, oh yeah, Doctor Strange, woo. But Cumberbatch is an actor. There's a reason why he only, you know, that's really the big blockbuster thing that he does. Everything else he really does is very character driven. So between, you know, something like this and something like The Courier, Cumberbatch really does lean more into these type of, you know, quieter films. But while I love Cumberbatch, and Cumberbatch is excellent, while I love Kirsten Dunst, and she's excellent, Jesse Plemons is just one of those dudes who I'm just so happy I'm starting to see more and more Jesse Plemons. And of course, in case you weren't aware, Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst are married in real life, lucky bastard. And and Jesse Plemons, between, you know, his role in The Irishman, between him in Game Night, between him in Judas and the Black Messiah, this dude is just fucking special. I love me some Jesse Plemons, and the way that him and Cumberbatch playing brothers go ahead and really kind of duel as the film goes on, as he falls more and more more in love with Rose, I loved it. I really loved their back and forth and their juxtaposition. And when the credits rolled and the ending, you know, the film ends with this incredible ending, I was just sitting there with my jaw just hanging open, and my partner and I were both like, wow, that's the ending? Fuck yes. It's, oh, it fucking rules. Power of the Dog, if you have not seen it, it's on Netflix. Watch that shit. It's so great. So great. That's my number five. My number four, I have made a lot of jokes about this brand, about this company, rightfully so, by the way, but I did say if there is anyone who would be able to make this film franchise work, it would be James fucking Gunn. My number four favorite film is The Suicide Squad, which is written and directed by James Gunn. So I had a couple people, because there are some people who have already seen the list, because I have this posted on my Letterboxd. I had a couple of my friends go, why is The Suicide Squad, because Suicide Squad was made by a less talented director. But I had a couple of my friends ask, why is The Suicide Squad on your list and not Spider-Man No Way Home? And the real short, simple answer is I expected to enjoy the hell out of No Way Home. I didn't expect to fall in love with The Suicide Squad. James Gunn is one of the best directors we have. He understands how to just get these comic book films and how to just nail these properties. And the fact that I had crying doesn't even get across, a hardcore weeping attack because of Ratcatcher 2 and a flashback between her and her dad, played by Taika Waititi. The fact that Ratcatcher fucking 2 was able to elicit such a intense response from me, I think that's fucking awesome. And it made me so happy to see what I believe last year was the best comic book film of last year. Again, love No Way Home, but I've always said on the podcast, fair is fair, you know, and I will always keep it real. And goddamn, the way that these characters felt human but despicable. sorry, does it sound like Daffy Duck? Despicable. I love the fact that they all seemed like pieces, like really all seemed like pieces of shit. Daniela Melchior, I think is how you say it, who plays Ratcatcher 2. This is her first major, this is like really her first big acting performance, period. And goddamn, girl, go ahead. She nails this shit. She's been on some TV series, but this is her first film role, and she absolutely crushes this. I pray we get to see more of her, because she was great. This also led to one of the best shows of this year so far in Peacemaker. John Cena absolutely nails the role of Peacemaker, which I'm so happy that he was able to. Idris Elba kills it as fucking Bloodsport. For me, this is the best iteration live action of Harley Quinn. Margot Robbie gets some incredible moments in this. King Shark, voiced by fucking Sylvester Stallone. Joel Kinnaman is way less proud boy in this, and it's just a badass as fucking Rick Flag. Viola Davis, horrifying as ever as Amanda Waller. I am so excited that it sounds like we're getting an Amanda Waller HBO Max show. Give me that tomorrow, please. I don't have a complaint about this film. The action is incredible. The violence, it feels gritty. It feels very much like a war film slash Western. I just dug this movie start to finish, and I own the steelbook of it. I've probably watched this start to finish 5 or 6 times since I bought it. Like, I dig this movie so much. And let James Gunn keep building, you know, more the Suicide Squad shit. James Gunn rules. This is great. Give me more of this. Please, please, please. Suicide Squad. That's my number four. Moving on to my number three. So I mentioned during my Oscar recap that there are a couple men who I believe got completely overlooked for Best Actor. One of them was Joaquin Phoenix. My number three favorite film of this year is the A24 film directed and written by Mike Mills, Come On, Come On. So this movie, Joaquin Phoenix stars as Johnny, who is a radio journalist. His sister is going through a really traumatic experience, so he offers to go ahead and babysit his nephew, her son, to go ahead and give her a break. And the chemistry between Woody Norman, who plays Jesse, the kid, and Joaquin Phoenix, it's one of my favorite pairings of actors, period, all of last year. Woody Norman doesn't have any acting credits. Well, okay, you know, that's a lie. He's got a couple TV movie stuff and some TV series stuff. This is obviously his biggest film role. And he's acting opposite one of the best actors of our generation. And he doesn't flinch. He feels like he belongs right there on screen with Joaquin. There are these moments between the two of them where you realize how much shit Jesse's gone through when you figure out the circumstances of why his mom needs a break. And the movie just kind of breaks your heart in a way that I was really not expecting. The way it's filmed in black and white. I'm a sucker for black and white. I fully acknowledge that. I'm just a sucker for black and white. But the cinematography on this is just beautiful. Anytime they're in a city like New Orleans or New York, the city itself feels like a character that's enhancing these interviews, that's enhancing the questions that these kids are giving. It really just makes you more captivated, more drawn to what you're seeing on screen. And there are some incredible moments, and I don't want to give really too many of them away, but there is this point where they go to New Orleans, and that whole section of the film is just incredibly well done. Johnny and Jesse have multiple conversations about why Johnny isn't as close to his mom, his sister, as he used to be. And the way that Johnny is trying to kind of shield Jesse from some of this shit, but the fact that Jesse he's smart enough to know, you know, you're not telling me the whole truth. It's a great back and forth that these characters engage in. And once the film stopped, I just went, okay, I want to watch this again. It's something I own now, and it's something that I've rewatched like twice since I bought it. It's not exactly a happy film, but it's definitely something that you need to see. As I mentioned, the score is absolutely amazing. If I was teaching a film class, this would be one of the first films I would show, just because it felt personal to the director. The interviews that Joaquin's Johnny gets from these kids really actually feels like these kids are giving these answers. It doesn't feel like a script at all, which I think is the biggest compliment I can pay this movie. I absolutely adore this movie. Please, please watch it. Again, this one is not streaming anywhere either, so you will have to pay for it, but I promise you it is well worth your money. Come On, Come On. That is my number three. All right, moving on to my number two. So I think that the man who stars in this movie should have won Best Actor. All due respect to Joaquin Phoenix, all due respect to Benedict, all due respect to Nick Cage. This was my favorite acting, male acting performance in this in 2021. I thought it was just captivating. I thought it was depressing in the best way. It spoke to me as an artist. It just makes me continue to love this actor more and more. It's amazing how this guy has took what was such a shit hand with The Amazing Spider-Man 2, and it's had this incredible resurgence of a career. My number two favorite film of 2021 is Tick, Tick, Boom, which is directed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, which, say what you will about Hamilton or, you know, In the Heights, say what you will about Lin-Manuel Miranda. I know he's like clinical depression. And he's everywhere, but let's call it what it is. The resurgence of the musical, the modern day musical. If we don't get Hamilton, we probably aren't having as many musicals as we are. We're probably not getting West Side Story remake, probably not getting In the Heights, we're not getting, you know, Encanto. we owe Lin-Manuel Miranda debt as far as getting people to get excited about musicals again, in the same way that, I know people want to hear this, in the same way that Glee helped, you know, almost wake some high schools up. Oh, wow, kids like arts and singing? What the hell? We owe Lin-Manuel Miranda a debt as far as really getting people to get into musicals again, in the same way that Wicked did the same thing. Hamilton did the exact same thing in that same sense. And this film, just off the opening number of 3090, I love the opening number. I thought the opening number fucking ruled. Andrew Garfield can fucking sing too, which I was like, oh, of course you can sing, you son of a bitch. It's an incredible experience to just sit back and witness how Andrew Garfield, you know, playing Jonathan Larson, how it feels, he feels like, you know, his life is running out. Oh my God, I haven't written my magnum opus yet. Oh my God, I'm almost 30. I'm 30. How can I keep functioning? I love his, the midlife crisis that he's really going through, in the way that an artist would push people away when they're spiraling. It feels like that with him and Susan, played by Alexandra Shipp, who of course from Straight Outta Compton, Love, Simon. She really is an incredible actress, and this is one of my favorite things I've seen her in. And the way that Garfield and Shipp play off each other is so heartbreaking, because if you know artists, this is exactly how some of these relationships kind of do break down and break up, because one of the artists just can't learn to separate their art and let it stop from bleeding into everything without it negatively affecting the people in their lives. And that I found incredibly tragic, but weirdly beautiful at the same time. But Garfield nails the angst of Jonathan Larson. He nails the franticness that he's feeling. Jesus, but I'm gonna say Robin de Jesus, because that's way funnier. He plays Mike, and there is a song, No More, that Garfield and him perform, that it's such a bop, and I was having so much fun just tapping my foot and going, yeah, this is fucking great. Anytime Garfield had it, I was like, come on, sing, motherfucker, sing. Like, Garfield is just special. I'm so happy that even though he didn't win the Oscar, which goddamn it, he deserved to win, this is at least just another check mark to go. This is one of the best actors we have. Give him more opportunities to be him. Give him more opportunities to show out, and he will not let you down. Lin-Manuel Miranda, he knows his way around a musical, so the direction on this is fucking flawless. Anytime there's a musical number, you feel like you're right there. When it cuts to the breaks where Jonathan is speaking to the audience, I love that. All those scenes as well. Bradley Whitford gets a very small role in this, but I always just love seeing Bradley Whitford because he's great. This movie's awesome. It's on Netflix. I'm assuming most people have seen it by now, but if you haven't, you owe it to yourself. You need to watch it. Tick, Tick, Boom, my number two. So, all right, let's run it back, everybody. So, I'm gonna go through my 10 through 2. So, tied for my number 10 is Ghostbusters Afterlife and Pig. Number 9 is Drive My Car. Number 8 is Last Night in Soho. Number 7 is Belfast. Number 6 is 9 Days. Number 5 is The Power of the Dog. Number 4 is The Suicide Squad. Number 3 is Come On, Come On. And my number 2 favorite film of 2021 is Tick, Tick, Boom, which leads to my number 1 favorite film of 2021. It's actually funny because I had Tick, Tick, Boom originally at my number 1. In case y'all haven't listened to one of these best stuffs before, I redo this list probably 10 to 15 times because it's like, oh, what about this movie? Oh, what about this? Oh, I haven't seen this. Oh, fuck. It's a lot of back and forth. It's a lot of juxtaposition. But I had Tick, 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 Boom at my number 1 until I saw this movie again and went, fuck, I like this like a hair more. My number 1 favorite film of 2021 is Coda. Look, I rarely think that the Academy gets the Best Picture winner correct, but this year, they fucking got it right. I am angry that Emilia Jones did not get a Best Actress nomination for her portrayal as Ruby Rossi, because she fucking deserved it and really should have won it. Like, I'm just gonna call it what it is. She should be a Best Actress winner already, and I believe she's like 19, but she should have won Best Actress. But what I love about this movie is that Marley Madeline, who plays her mom, Jackie, and Troy Kotsur, who plays Frank, her dad, who did win Best Supporting Actor, which great, sir, just fucking bravo, sir. You fucking earned that shit. The way that Jackie and Frank gaslight Ruby as she's just trying to live her life and go off to school because, you know, they're deaf. And so they need her to translate, but they don't want to pay for a translator, and she has aspirations to go ahead and go off to school to be a singer and, you know, get into music. And the way that her family is really acting like an anchor and trying to keep her home and call it what it is, gaslighting her like there's no fucking tomorrow and guilting her into staying. It's a fucking heartbreaking tale. But it's one of those tales that it's a really good message of, yes, obviously, you know, the fact that they're deaf, that I can't imagine how, you know, difficult that must be for them. But she is your kid and she deserves to have her own life. And what does, you know, having your own life look like when you're in these circumstances? There are some incredibly funny moments, including a moment involving sex, which I really didn't think about given the fact that her parents are deaf, and you just go, oh shit, this would be a really uncomfortable situation if this were to happen to you. I'm gonna butcher his name, Eugenio Derbez, who I see him and stuff, and I'm always kind of like, he's kind of hit and miss for me. I did think How to Be a Latin Lover was dumb as hell, but I had so much fun with it. The Overboard remake is, it's fucking terrible, but I really like him. What's that show? Acapulco, I think. Pretty good show. It's on Apple TV. But the dynamic between Derbez and Jones, Derbez playing Bernardo, who is Ruby's choir teacher. I love their dynamic. He challenges her in the way that a teacher should challenge a student and push a student, and they get into some shit as far as some conversations that I was pleasantly surprised that the film was willing to go there. The movie itself just makes you feel good at the end of the day. It makes you cry. You will cry. You will definitely cry watching this, but I felt so hopeful by the time the credits rolled. I really wanted to watch it again once the credits rolled. And it's a movie that is on Apple TV. I know not a ton of people have have Apple TV unless Ted Lasso is on. But honest to God, y'all, check this movie out. Again, I rarely think that the best picture winner is the best film of the year. In this case, it is 1,000% the best film of 2021. It is Coda, and it is my favorite film of 2021. So that's it, y'all. I can actually officially say goodbye to 2021. What were your favorite films of 2021? I would love to hear what everyone loved last year. Please let us know in the comments. You can follow yours truly on the Twitter at @JHunterRealPineapple. You can follow the show, like both our pages, on Facebook at The Real Pineapple. That's R-E-E-L Pineapple, and Real Pineapple Games. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. You can find The Real Pineapple most places you listen to podcasts: SoundCloud, Apple, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Amazon Music, to name a few, at The Real Pineapple. And you can find me on Letterboxd at Black Shazam. And you can find me on TikTok at BlackShazam775. We will have reviews coming up here soon for Moon Knight, as well as some other stuff coming down the pipeline. It's a little slow for new releases for the next couple weeks, so we'll just have some random stuff for you. But everyone, stay safe out there. Go get your COVID shot. Get your booster if you haven't gotten it. Take care of each other. Tell someone you love them today, and we will talk to you soon.